Welcome to the Kanem, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. Thrilled to have with us during this hour someone who has posted regularly on the Troubled Times Forum for survival concepts and information. Mike has been our strongest contributor there by far, bar none. Most people who have read the Troubled Times pages consider him almost like a god, and I say this jokingly because that's not how he thinks of himself, but he's very technically versed, very familiar with electrical concepts, and not only will provide the information he has, but goes to the extent of putting together prototypes, testing them out, taking photographs, and providing all this to the Troubled Times website and to the Troubled Times forum participants. I asked Mike to be with us for an hour and discuss primitive survival electrical networks, which probably will be running on 12-volt electricity, perhaps direct current and the like, how to gen electricity with windmills, water mills, what to do about breaking light bulbs and when you run out. Those kind of issues have been discussed a lot on Troubled Times from its inception in 1996 to the present. And at the core of that, we find Mike sharing his information and trying, experimenting in his basement, putting things together, and sharing the results of his prototype experiments. Well, without further ado, we'll bring Mike on board. And first, I want to ask Mike, what is electricity exactly? It shows up in nature as a spark or a lightning bolt, but the electricity challenged are used to taking this for granted, flipping the switch and the lights come on and the appliances work. But the how of this is a mystery to most, yes, certainly to me. I'm one of the electricity challenged, and don't I know it. Mike, can you explain?
Yes, thank you for the warm welcome. And I wish to be technically correct. I will be using some notes prepared. Please bear with me on this. I will answer by talking about basics. Electricity is just a flow of electrons. Electrons are a very small particle with a negative charge. Electricity is a particle flow. It's analogous to water flow. You mentioned lightning bolt as a spark in nature. Some people think these electrons are created at the point of the spark. This is not the case. Electrons are in everything. They are in the clouds, in the air. When they get pushed in a direction, say between clouds, with enough pressure, they produce the spark you see. Current is measured in amperes. 1 ampere is 63 with 17 zeros after it of electrons flowing in a conductor past a given point in 1 second. If you had a little spiritual being watching the flow in a wire in 1 second and was able to count real fast, 63 with 17 zeros after it, electrons, then you'd have 1 amp. This number is not important to remember. The main concept to remember is 1 amp is a large quantity of electrons flowing past a given location in 1 second. In the water analogy, this would be the same as counting the number of water molecules that go past a given location in any 1 unit of time. This, again, would be a very large number, so we typically measure this in cubic feet per minute, or more practically, bucketfuls per hour. No one likes to work with numbers large, so in like manner, the word amperes has been assigned a given quantity flow of electrons in a unit of time. Now, rather than count electrons each time we use them, we can measure them by the number of bucketfuls per second, or simply by saying so many amps. Voltage is analogous to pressure. In the water analogy, the height of water determines the amount of pressure. Take the case of old-fashioned water tower that used to be prevalent in cities long ago. The height of the tank provides the pressure. Those living in lower areas get more pressure. Pressure in water is measured in pounds per square inch. In like manner, voltage is the amount of pressure behind any given electron to cause it to move in the conductor. A typical car battery, for example, has a pressure of 12 volts. 1 volt is the amount of pressure necessary to force 1 amp of electrons through a resistor of 1 ohm producing 1 watt of power. We have all felt the heat from a 100-watt light bulb, so we have an idea what 1 watt could approximately be. 1 ohm is the unit of electrical resistance equal to the resistance between 2 points on a conductor when a potential difference of 1 volt between them produces a current of 1 amp. What this is saying is when you can take a wire and measure 1 volt from one end to the other with a current of 1 amp flowing, you have a wire that has a resistance of 1 ohm. This is just an arbitrary amount of resistance based on earlier defined terms. In the water analogy, the smaller the pipe, the larger the resistance of flow. In like manner, the smaller the electrical conductor, the larger the resistance. Now back to your mystery of flipping the switch and the light comes on. When one takes a very small wire of tungsten and forces lots of electrons to go through it, what happens? Resistance of the particles flowing cause heat, and this heat has to escape somehow. For any given wire, a low flow might give off heat, as a toaster does in the infrared, or a larger flow would give off light, as light bulbs do in the visible range. An even larger flow of electrons would melt the wire. This is what happens in a fuse. No mystery here, just small particles that are not able to be seen with the naked eye that are flowing, doing work for us. A watt is the product of the voltage in the circuit and the current in amperes or amps. 1,000 watts is equal to 1 kilowatt. When 1 watt of load is used for 1 hour, it will consume 1 watt hour of power. DC stands for direct current and is the flow in one direction. AC stands for alternating current and is a push-pull flow at the rate of 60 times per minute. The following formulas result for DC circuits. Volts equals current in amps times resistance in ohms. Power in watts equals volts times current in amps, and watt hours equals watts times hours of use. Ampere hours is simply equal to the flow from a battery times the number of hours it flows. These simple formulas are very valuable for determining what is needed in a circuit to make it work correctly. For understanding batteries and power sources, does this answer the question on the subject?
Oh, you more than answered it, Mike. Thanks. And I've got the general idea that we're dealing with, you know, how fast do the electrons flow, what's the force, the push behind them, how much resistance, and the like. And as I recall, you know, if I'm lining up what kind of batteries an appliance needs, they're always telling you that you have to, you know, match the push, the force, the flow with what the appliance needs. Or you know, like, can you plug it into the wall, or do you need a transformer, for instance, and the like, and that kind of makes sense. So now that we know that electricity is kind of electrons on the move, and all these terms are just defining various aspects of that, I'll get to the next burning question, which is alternating current, AC versus DC. Now we all know what that means in street slang and sexual orientation, but really, this came from alternating current or direct current. Direct meaning, I guess, it's moving in one direction, and alternating meaning it's switching back and forth. But why wouldn't all electricity just be direct current? and I've always puzzled about this. This seems a more direct approach, so to speak. And are both systems being used in the world of electrical appliances, AC and DC? Is this something I need to be aware of, like when I'm planning my survival sites and what kind of appliances I might be able to use there? What are we getting now in our electric service from the electric company? Are we getting AC or DC? And are setups either or? I mean, can they be both, or do they have to be one or the other? I mean, are they mutually exclusive? In particular, what does this mean for life after the coming pole shift for survival groups? I found something on the Troubled Times energy pages in the energy section talking about pros and cons of AC versus DC, and I'd like to just quote from that. The AC that we use in our home leaves the source, the generation plant, with a voltage of many thousands of volts. It is then distributed to a series of substations, which, using transformers, ultimately reduce the voltage running along the power lines along the street to several hundreds of volts, finally to your normal 120 to 120 volts AC that comes into individual houses. Were DC to be used at the generation plant for distribution such a long distance, huge power lines would be required. Therefore, you would have very much higher voltages coming into your home, i.e. a dangerous situation. Edison first lit parts of New York City with his new electric lights using DC, direct current. Death rates were enormous because of very high voltages hanging over the streets and sometimes falling and going into homes where accidents happen. If one does accidentally get a hold of a high voltage DC line, one can't let go, where with AC, the opposite is true. Westinghouse developed AC and went into competition with the Edison Electric Company, and in short order, DC was relegated to low-voltage battery applications. DC devices, such as made for camping, require less push because DC is the source. The battery is only a few feet away. DC conserves energy, especially when the production and use are in the same locale. DC camping lamps and heaters or whatever use 12 volts. End of the quote. So, is that true? I mean, is that the only thing that prevails, that we use DC for camping and we use alternating current for big grids, and that's where it ends? What do you think?
Well,
what do you think, Mike?
Back in Thomas Edison's day, he was the inventor of the light bulb. He championed DC, direct current that flows in one direction only. And during the same time frame, there was a person by the name of Nikola Tesla who championed AC, or alternating current, a push-pull flow from generating plant. And we can see the results now from Westinghouse and various companies. AC won out because it had advantages of using transformers for distribution. At higher voltages, it's less dangerous than the DC. AC is easier to step up to higher voltages using step-up transformers to allow it to be piped over a long distance than DC. DC will not work with transformers. DC is easier to store as a chemical energy in batteries, thus used for portability. And that's where we get our DC for portability. As a result, today we only get AC from our electric companies. We can convert this to DC as needed to charge batteries. Batteries give us energy storage and portability. I believe power after the coming pole shift will most likely take two forms, 12-volt and 115-volt AC. 12-volt batteries will be used for storage. 115-volt AC will be used for those items we have that will not run directly on 12 volts. A DC to AC inverter will be used to convert from 12-volt DC to 115-volt AC when needed. Plan on having several inverters, each with different power ratings. Use the one with the lowest rating that will work at the time. This saves power usage in the long run. The ones with lower power ratings draw lower amounts of current when idling with the inverter on and with no AC power being used. Thus, they're more efficient. After the pole shift, the use of existing 12-volt car batteries for some will be the only thing available. When preparing before a pole shift, select and purchase 6 large 2-volt cells and wire them in series to produce 12 volts. This gives the most economical, maintainable setup. For portable batteries, use AAA through D size rechargeable nickel metal hydride or nickel cadmium batteries. Nickel cadmium holds less and has a slower internal leakage, so it will stay charged up longer. Nickel cads can be used in clocks and things that don't use much current over time. Nickel metal hydride works good for portable communication devices or where lightweight and more power is needed. Does this answer your question on this subject?
Sure covered AC to DC. Questions about batteries. Never been able to figure this out, although to be honest, I haven't dug it out and researched it, but I'm confused. How do batteries work? How can chemistry hold electricity? And why do the electrons move from one side of the battery to the other? There's something on the Troubled Times pages that implies different metal on one side and the other side. So there's a natural flow of electrons in that direction. I mean, maybe one kind of metal being an attractant and another kind of a metal being a giver-outer or push-pull. It seems these different types of metals, zinc and iron, that they are describing are not touching, but a fluid is in between them. So maybe one metal has, say, attraction and pull for electrons, and the other normally has an excess or natural push for electrons, perhaps. I mean, that's my guess. And let me give you this quote from the Boy Mechanic, an article in a magazine, I guess, describing a homemade battery and an emphasis that the different metal types should not touch. They're describing using plaster of Paris and paraffin and Vaseline to prevent any kind of touching of the metal. So a flow starts between them via the fluid only, going through a fluid that they put in. They don't talk about battery acid. They're talking about an alkaloid fluid instead, but whatever. It allows the flow to go through the fluid from one metal to the next. And I guess the poles, positive and negative, of the battery are attached to the different metal types. I mean, that's what I make out of this article, which is describing a homemade battery. And let me quote, and so we're all aware of what I'm talking about. The following is copied from the Boy Mechanic. The high cost of dry cells has encouraged many to make and use homemade cells of various kinds, and this one described has the merit of cheapness and efficiency, as well as long life. For the battery jar, an old can about 6 inches high and 4 inches in diameter is used. A porous cup is required, and this is made by rolling a strip of blotting paper around a stick, maybe 1.5 inches in diameter, and securing the ends with melted paraffin. The bottom of the cup is made by standing it in a smooth surface which has been greased with Vaseline and pouring in plaster of Paris or melted paraffin to a depth of about 1/2 inch. When completed, the porous cup is stood in the center of the can. The outside space is filled with chips, borings, and turnings of iron, and a strip of zinc then is placed inside the cup as shown in the drawing from this article. Well, I'm going to drop that. And a strip of zinc is placed inside the cup. The battery solution is made by dissolving caustic soda, powdered lye, in water until it will take no more, a saturation solution, in other words. The cell is filled with this solution to bring it within 1 inch of the top, and connection is made with a zinc strip and the can by means of binding posts, positive or negative poles. Owing to the caustic character of the battery solution, it should not be allowed to come into contact with the skin or clothing. Such a cell has a voltage of about 1.2 and will deliver approximately 2 amperes on short circuit, depending on the purity of the chemicals and the fineness of the borings and burnings. The internal resistance of these cells is high, and the best results are obtained by connecting a battery of them in parallel. If a large amount of current is required, However, one or two set cells will give good results for light service, such as a doorbell circuit. End of the quote from Boy Mechanic. Well, what do you think, Mike? Is that how batteries work?
Yep, that's how batteries. It's a little bit too complex to really make in a primitive environment. But this example you read about can be visualized as simply as a plate of zinc and one of iron with a strong base of lye for the fluid in between. And you can make it as such in a primitive environment. Just three things. As explained in your statement, it produces 1.5 volts. In actuality, any two different metals can be made into a battery. All that is needed is a strong acid or sometimes a strong base. Some metals work better than others, and some acids and bases work better than others. This is all a given. However, in a primitive environment, you have what you have as a result of scrounging. For example, sulfuric acid can be made from sulfur found around volcanic activity. Yellow sulfur melts in superheated steam from underground and comes to the surface where it cools. To make sulfuric acid, sulfur is burned with lots of oxygen and the fumes passed over or through water, preferably distilled water. The water near volcanic activity can also contain sulfuric acid. It can also contain other salts that are not good for a battery to hold a charge. A primitive lye can be made from wood ashes as a result of a camp or forest fires. The other thing one needs to know about batteries is the more the surface area for each battery, the higher the amount of stored energy. Current carrying capacity is directly related to the surface area of the plates. Each type of battery has different chemistry. Some works better than others. Within a chemical reaction, there is stored the pressure of pushing electrons. When discharging occurs, the chemical reaction is going into a lower energy state and forcing electrons to be pushed out of the negative plate in a battery with a given pressure or voltage. Chemical reactions are basically ions or compounds that have a charge when in solution. They move in the solution to the plate they like the most, and in the process put pressure on electrons in that plate. When they get to the negative plate, they put pressure on electrons to flow out of that plate. When they get to the positive plate, they want to pull electrons into it. And an important concept is electrons are not being created in the battery. They are only being pumped or pushed from one plate to the other because of stored chemical energy. The direction of flow is determined by the element and compounds used in each plate. The reaction is usually reversible. One can pump electrons in the reverse direction to charge the battery and store energy as chemical reaction. An example is the lead acid cell. A fully charged cell has the negative plate made of spongy lead. The lead in the plate is actually spongy, so it has a lot of surface area. The positive plate is made of lead peroxide. The electrolyte is mostly sulfuric acid. For a full discharged cell, both plates are made up of a coating of lead sulfate, and electrolyte is mostly water. The cell discharges when the electrolyte or acid becomes water, and the positive plate or lead peroxide is used up. The negative plate for this cell is more to complete the electrical circuit than anything else. The cell charges when a lead sulfate goes into solution making sulfuric acid and the positive plate becomes lead peroxide again. Batteries are often rated in ampere hours. This is the number of amps that can be delivered in 1 hour. It is a figure of merit that gives a measure of the number of electrons able to be pushed down a wire by a battery over a given time. Does this answer your question on the subject?
Oh, it answered the question and more questions emerged. You mentioned putting batteries in a series so the flow is stronger. I remember in that article I quoted, they said, well, the battery should be put in parallel. Well, what does that mean? What's the difference, series or parallel? And also, what does it mean for a battery to go bad? I mean, does it drag the other batteries in a series or parallel setup down? I suppose there are ways to test if a battery is good or bad. And what does it mean, and can you do anything to recover it? Does the metal get eaten up during that process? Does it mean that the fluid is no longer acid or no longer alkaline? I'm just a little confused about it because, you know, you have a car battery, you go and you buy a new one, they pop it in the car, now the car starts real readily, and everything's fine. And after a pole shift or a cataclysm, when we're in survival communities and we're dealing with batteries that have gone bad, and we may have to, like, try to renovate it or maintain it or maybe create a new battery with very little resources, it's good to have some sort of a concept of what the heck are we doing here. Can you help us out?
Sure. Let's talk about series first. When cells or batteries are connected positive terminal to negative terminal, they are end-to-end. They are said to be in series. For a water flow analogy, consider an output of one fire truck connected to the input of another fire truck. Can you predict the result? The last fire truck can shoot water much higher than any one truck. It would be the same amount of water, but with much more pressure. This would have the application of for a fire in a tall building, like the Twin Towers. So to answer your question, yes, this increase in pressure could be considered to be a strong flow. Batteries wired in series make for more voltage. One adds up the voltage of each cell to get the result for the series connection. The current flow is still the same as any one battery in the string. If one battery cell in series stops working, then the flow is stopped or slowed down for the rest. It can be only slowed down. It may not end up to be stopped. Remember this when it comes to 12-volt batteries, for they are made up of 6 cells, 2 volts each in series. When cells or batteries are connected with positive terminal to positive and negative to negative, they are said to be in parallel. For a water flow analogy, consider 4 fire trucks in parallel side by side, all pumping their water in a fire. All pumping their water on a fire. One adds up the quantity of water from each to get the total volume. Each is limited to the pressure that it can generate from one truck, so the pressure is the same for each. This would be good for a low building fire. Batteries so connected, the current adds up to be the sum of each. 4 batteries so connected, the current adds up to be the sum of each. Voltage ends up to be the same as any one of them. After several years of working with 6 and 12-volt batteries at a seldom-visited remote site, I finally learned a few valuable lessons worth sharing. When building and using battery banks for remote power, the following practical rules apply. General Rule 1. Do not connect a number of 12 batteries in parallel to make a long-term use battery bank. Found this is a good way to kill off good batteries in short order. Sooner or later, there is invariably one weak cell in the bunch. This weak cell will drain the charge of the rest of the good batteries and ultimately make them bad. A weak or bad cell is one that loses its charge rapidly due to internal leakage. The resulting individual 12-volt battery becomes around 11 volts or lower if allowed to set for a week or so. Excessive internal leakage can be a result of oversulfation in the cell. Most 12-volt batteries are sealed on the top and do not allow for measurement of individual cell voltages. To find a bad cell in a parallel connection of many 12-volt batteries, one has to charge the parallel combination and then disconnect all batteries and let them sit for a few days to a week. The batteries with bad cells will ultimately show up with voltages below 12 volts. In a low-tech survival environment where one needs to use the batteries daily, this becomes impractical. A better approach is to use one battery at a time for power. From time to time, completely charge it and rotate it out to then use another. watch the voltage of the battery sitting idle to get an idea of how good or bad they are. If you really are on top of it and watching it and need the extra immediate power, then go for several in parallel at the most. Try to match up batteries that have the same internal leakage or self-discharge rate when doing this. Don't leave it hooked up this way for the long term. Bottom line, it is better to let a good battery sit idle when charged than to put it in parallel with other 12-volt batteries. The weakest one will pull down all the rest and make the majority go bad before their normal lifetime is up. Thus the rule, do not connect 12-volt batteries in parallel to make a long-term use bank. Rule 2, the deeper the discharge state of a battery, the shorter the time one should wait to charge it. If one leaves a 12-volt discharged for a month or longer, it will not fully charge due to sulfation. The sulfation promotes dead or leaky cells. The longer it is left in a discharge state, the less capacity it will have if it holds a charge at all. If a battery is only partially discharged, say 70%, then the battery can set for much longer, say 6 months, before it sulfates very much. Sulfation forms when a cell is discharged. Non-reversible sulfation results when the battery sits for too long a time in a partially discharged condition. The sulfation crystals become hard and irreversible with time. As a result, they do not go back into solution during charging. The battery is considered to be sulfated. Sulfated battery can sometimes be cured by overcharging it for over a week or so at a minimum of 15 volts. Due to the lack of power, this can be hard to do in a primitive survival situation. Another way is to drain the battery acid and put distilled water in the cells. Let it sit for 1 hour. Charge it at about 4-amp rate until hydrometer reading does not change over a period of time. This attempts to redissolve most of the sulfate crystals back into solution. Then drain and save this new wash acid. Wash the sediment out of the cell with more distilled water. If you use non-distilled water, it can introduce salts that cause the battery to lose charge rapidly. Replace with new acid if you have it. If in a primitive environment, boil down the wash acid to make it stronger, then combine the original saved acid with the newly created wash acid and continue to slowly boil it down to an amount that will just fit back into the original battery. Use a non-corrosive or glass container to accomplish this. If the specific gravity gets between 1.25 and 1.3, then you have enough acid left to do the job. If you are making a long-term use battery, use 6 high-capacity single 2-volt cells in series to make a single 12-volt battery. Get one extra cell to replace one that may go bad in the future. Choose an ampere-hour rating that matches your charging capability. If you use a windmill and only get a small amount of ampere-hours out of your wind, don't choose a high-capacity battery bank. You will never keep it charged. The internal leakage will be too much. The advantage of this method is one can from time to time measure the voltage of each single cell while in operation. This is done by comparing the voltages of each. The one with the consistent lowest voltage is the one most likely to go bad. It will be the one with the greatest internal leakage. Rule number 4, when using a gasoline generator and a battery charger, determine your charging rate in amps and divide that into the ampere-hour rating of the battery to get how many hours you need to run your generator. For example, 40 amps divided into 200 ampere-hour for a battery would equal 5 hours for a full charge. From time to time, say every month or two, overcharge the battery bank to balance out the cells. This is called equalization. This ensures each cell is fully charged and ends up to be approximately the same voltage. Cells become imbalanced with respect to the state of charge with time if they're never fully charged. This is due to different internal leakage rates of each cell. Rule 5, determine your state of charge by measuring voltage for a battery in a resting state. This is a state of not being charged and not discharging and has not been actively being charged for more than 12 hours. Bottom line, wait 12 hours or more after charging and turn off all load and measure the voltage. A voltage of between 12.6 and 13 volts indicates a full charge, and a voltage between 11.4 and 12.0 indicates discharge depending on the local temperature and age of battery. Do not bother to purchase expensive meters that measure state of charge. They end up, from personal experience, being more trouble than they are worth. A simple, low-cost digital voltmeter from Harbor Freight will work fine. Search for item 90899, costs $2.99, or item 30756 for $9.99. Both are multi-tester and will work fine. Any digital meter will work fine. Internal leakage and sulfation are the prominent variables that determine useful battery life that one needs to become familiar with and watch for. Batteries do wear out with respect to charging and discharging. When this happens, the negative plate is mostly still there as lead. The positive plate is usually eaten up, and there is a lot of lead sulfate down in the bottom of the cell. A PDF composed, ready-to-print file can be downloaded from Troubled Times Files area for the TT Forum under the folder Batteries and Battery Power. The file Batteries Lesson Learned has all the details of what I just discussed plus graphics. With respect to your question on does the fluid have to be acid or alkali, this is a good question. The answer is no. There is such a thing as saltwater batteries. There are seawater batteries patented that utilize seawater as electrolyte metals such as aluminum or magnesium at the positive terminal and solid insoluble chlorides as the negative terminal. A typical combination is silver chloride as the negative plate and, for example, magnesium for the positive plate. One can also use lead chloride, cuprous chloride, or lead chloride / cuprous chloride or positive plate, a combination of both. A very simple construction that produces about 0.5 volts can be made from a penny and a zinc-plated screw put in salt water. 8 of these cells in series are enough to run an LED nightlight. Copper and aluminum will produce 0.3-volt cell. In a survival situation, one should try other metals that might be available to see what one can get. Does this answer your question on this subject?
I've become educated. Thank you, Mike. It's forming in my head how a battery works and what I might do in the aftertime, you know, with a bunch of chemicals and metals and the like to try to recreate a battery or repair my batteries. Survival situation, survivors can usually grab up a bunch of car batteries. Cars won't be that functional because the roads will be tore up, and they can probably find in hardware stores or auto stores and the like plenty of batteries on the shelf. And those are usually, I think, dry batteries. They don't have a solution put in them. They're referred to as dry batteries. But maybe other types of batteries to use as well. I've heard like golf carts use batteries. There's different sizes. So if a battery's worn out in the aftertime or after the pole shift, I suppose we can replace them, building them from scratch. But in the main, we'd want to repair what we have and run with it as long as possible, I think. They can be rebuilt, can't they?
Yes, they can be rebuilt. There are always options. there is the previous discussed batteries where the electrolyte is salt water battery, strong base, or strong acid, and the use of any two dissimilar metals. How to make acids in basic solutions was discussed earlier to some extent also. To some extent, lead-acid batteries can be rebuilt. The first thing to try is to desulfate using distilled water trick described earlier. As a last result, one can salvage the sulfated lead plates from the negative plates of a battery and reset them in a container using half of them as positive plates with a weak solution of sulfuric acid and start charging. One should reverse the charge on the plates for a few cycles, then settle down with one polarity. This is basically how the first lead-acid batteries were made. You could burn in oxygen some lead and then try pasting some of the newly formed lead peroxide and lead oxide onto the positive plate and use battery strength sulfuric acid. Run it through several charge and discharge cycles. This is basically a simple explanation of how modern batteries are made. However, there is a lot of patented know-how in doing this. A good book for the survivalist is called Secrets of Lead Acid Essentials, Knowledge for Alternate Energy Applications by T.J. Lindsay. Does this answer your question on this subject?
Yeah, I'm going to go buy that book. Secrets of Lead Acid Batteries, Essential Knowledge for Alternative Energy Applications by T.J. Lindsay. One for my library. Okay, we've got our batteries down now. The grid is down, but we can't keep the lights on forever from batteries. We need to generate power, right? If only to charge the batteries. Assuming that windmills and water wheels will be some of the most reliable sources, and gas power generators unlikely to be fueled for long after a cataclysm like a pole shift, what does this take? And I know we've discussed this a lot on Troubled Times, how to gen power. Let me quote from some of the stuff you, Mike, have written in the past for Troubled Times. And I take this from Bike Generation Power, Bike Gen Power. And I quote, a stationary supported normal bicycle or an exercise cycle can be used to generate electricity and charge a 12-volt battery. The unit can be made from commonly available parts with not much time needed for assembly. The sustainable output power is between 10 to 45 watts, with peak power at about 100 watts. Low-cost, commonly available cordless drills can be used as the generator. And from another page, take the front wheel off and mount the remaining yoke on a stable platform made of wood. Use the same bolt holes that held the wheel on. Raise that rear wheel so that the rear wheel turns freely and bolt this to the platform. Take the rear wheel tire off the rim and use the groove of the rim as a pulley. Use the pulley already on the generator and install a long belt around these pulleys. Because of the size difference, the generator will turn many times to that of the bicycle rim. One body pedaling is not going to produce much power. 100 to 300 watts is my current guess. Don't figure on running anything but essentials. Takes too much energy. It takes battery storage and a DC to AC inverter to run most well pumps. Incandescent lights will run on 120 volt DC. This would take 10 charged batteries in series. Fluorescent lights will not work on DC, so an inverter would be needed. End of the quotes. Well, I've seen the diagrams, which we have in Troubled Times, and it's like the front wheel is fixed so that it doesn't really go anywhere or do anything. And the rear wheel is hiked up in the air, and the tire taken off the rim, and its pulley around the rim and something else that is turning to generate electricity. The person pedaling away is turning that rear wheel, which is flying like crazy, but the bike isn't going anywhere because it's up and suspended, basically, on this platform. And as the rear wheel spins around with the pulley on it, something else somewhere is getting turned and turned. And that's generating electricity, which is another thing that kind of puzzles me. Just because something is turning and turning, I'm not sure why that should make electricity, but what do you think about this bike gen, windmills, watermills? I know you've done some experimenting on your own, Mike, tried all of these things to some degree, and what's your prognosis as the best approach?
early on, I thought that you could generate from 100 to 300 watts. Later on, it turned out it's going to be less than 100 watts that any person's going to be able to generate. And that depends on the efficiency of the generator. Basically, after the pole shift, gasoline or diesel generators will be used until the fuel runs out. These will be used to charge batteries for a while. Gas generators, generator power output should be matched to the maximum charging rate of the battery bank to minimize runtime and save fuel. Targets run it only once, maybe every week or two. Charging batteries and generating power over the long term will be by using windmill such as AirX from WindPower and AeroGen that sells for about $1,000 with power included. Micro hydropower, hand cranking, battery powered portable electric drill generators, and water powered portable drill generators and bicycle powered portable drill generators will be other methods of generating power. The value of micro hydropower should not be underestimated. An off-the-shelf water pump that has an induction motor to run it can actually be converted into an AC generator. One runs a pipe upstream to get enough head pressure to turn this pump at close to rated speed. One adds a few AC capacitors. One adds a few AC capacitors to tune it to 60 cycle resonance. Then start it turning. And a quick zap with a bit of DC to get the magnetic field going, and voila, you have a micro hydropower that can actually produce 60 cycles of alternating current. It can produce as much voltage as the pump is rated for. This could be 120 volts or 240 volts or something else. This is in common practice in developing countries like India. For how to implement this, pick a copy of Pumps as Turbines, a User Guide by author Williams, and Motors as Generators for Micro Hydropower by Nigel Smith. Does this answer your question on this subject?
Yes, it does. And I myself would love to get into some of that, build some of these prototypes or get them going, but don't really have the expertise or the time to do that. But I think any survival camp should have somebody who's comfortable with these concepts of, you know, putting together a windmill, putting together a watermill. I remember one of the things that you did for Trouble Times was an experiment where you had a water wheel that was nothing more than a bunch of Tupperware bowls that were hitched as a wheel so that the water, well, like the old mills that we see where water in a river, for instance, would turn or falling down a falls, would turn the wheel by falling into a cup, driving the wheel round and round. You had that set up and you used a garden hose to keep the wheel going round and round, and you were attaching this to an electric drill to drive it backwards where the drill would turn and the drill head would turn and the electricity would come out the wires, which I thought was fascinating, and this actually worked, in that you put this rig together and it worked, and I'm in awe of that because I can't do that. But I think every survival community should have somebody who loves to tinker and do this stuff and is comfortable with electrical concepts and is not afraid of even small water power, even something, the water running down your drains, for instance, might be able to create a trickle of electricity, and certainly something in a stream or a river. And if you're on a hillside, water dropping off of a steep hill can often have a force of flow that can be utilized, and anything in a pinch. But this is something that is renewable, doesn't pollute the environment, and highly recommended that people get familiar with these concepts ahead of time and start tinkering. back to how that drill worked, and it was something that fascinated me, that you use the normal process is plug an electric drill into the wall, and the drill head goes round and round, drills a hole. You had it rigged so that that drill was replaced with some kind of a handle that could be attached to whatever's going round and around, the windmill, the watermill, or the bike wheel. And that round and around went backwards into the drill and created electricity flowing out of the wires that you'd normally plug into the wall. So almost like an electromagnetic power generator. Well, I'm curious about how electrons get started flowing from something that is going around and around inside that drill. The electrons seem to be maybe chasing the magnet in an electromagnetic power generator. In other words, the magnet is turning and the electrons are chasing the magnet. That's my guess. Let me quote what you said about that drill setup. And I quote, "Hook up two cordless drills to charge a 12-volt battery. A bicycle-driven emergency battery charger can be made rather simply from two cordless permanent magnet drills and commonly available parts that will produce from 10 to 45 watts charging capacity. This can be used to charge 12-volt storage batteries or a modified NiCad battery pack." End of the quote. So you're referring to a magnet in there somewhere, a permanent magnet, and that somehow piece of the magic that produces electricity from an around and around. Right, Mike?
Yes, that's correct. There is a basic known observation or fact in electricity that if one passes a wire through a magnetic field, electrons will begin to flow. The faster one moves the wire, the higher the pressure or voltage on every electron in the wire trying to push it out of the wire. Note that there's more resistance to pushing it through the field when it is pushed faster. What is happening is we are converting mechanical energy into pumping the electrons in the wire in one direction or another. The shape and design of the motor or generator allows for maximum change in magnetic field strength across a coil of wire. A simple AC generator might be pictured as a horseshoe magnet with a coil of wire rotating around on a shaft between the north and south poles. In like manner, a typical alternator or motor has field coils around the outside of an armature that rotates on the shaft. These field coils draw current to make the strong magnetic field that the wires in the armature cut through. If in place of these coils we place a set of permanent magnets, then we do not have to waste any of the generated current to produce this field. Thus, this becomes the design of most permanent magnet motors. Any permanent magnet motor can be used as a generator. That's very important. If you find something that's a permanent magnet motor, just turn it and you've got a generator. All one has to do is keep it turning in the same direction as the motor would be turning to produce the same plus or minus polarity across the output wire leads. Battery-operated hand drills are designed to be light and portable. Thus, they use permanent magnet motors, which can be used as generator by simply turning them. Test this for yourself. Take the battery pack out of any battery-operated hand drill and hook a couple of jumper leads to a voltmeter or an ammeter, then hold the trigger down and see what you get while turning the chuck by hand. If this generates electricity, then the unit has a permanent magnet motor in it. PDF composed, ready-to-print files can be downloaded from Troubled Times area file for the TT Forum under the folder DC Power. There are four files that have all the details of how to make DC power with these portable drills along with graphics. Does this answer your question on this subject?
Thank you so much, Mike, for being with us this hour and explaining all these complicated concepts for the electricity challenge, which I am one. What has always occurred to me, and I've always said my feeling, you don't give people bad news until you tell them what they can do about it. And Troubled Times has done that from the start, has told them what they can do about it. It's the best website. I know that because people have looked around and looked for something comparable. Nobody else is doing this. We are.
Yeah.
We did it. And we did it so effectively from 96 to 2001 or 2 or whatever that it's today still stands as, just the monument. So, and we have these CDs ready, and, you know, at cost, the Troubled Times nonprofit is ready to go, and blah, blah. What I've always thought would happen, when this really hits the news, and there's some credibility to, you know, the whole theory about what's coming, credibility to what the Zetas have said, and really, I've done up 1 hour called The Astonishing Zeta Talk Accuracy, for instance. Just 18 examples that cannot be denied, where the Zetas came out and said blah blah, even if it flew in the face of modern science, like, you know, like the sun flipping its poles every 11 years, even if it flew in the face, and how later that proved to be true, as examples of their accuracy, and certainly in the season of the second sun that went through the hole, you know, it showed up in 2001, 2, and 3, just where the Zetas said it would be, with a remarkable pinpoint, you know, of Ra and declination in the sky. So I have that out there, but let's say we, this gets out there on TV and radio, and everybody's saying, wow, I got to have this information, you know, and I've often thought that corporations, as a benefit to their employees or something, could just, you know, burn a bunch of CDs or run a printing press and document these little survival books and that type of thing and hand them out for free.
Exactly.
And that kind of thing should be encouraged. So the main thing is to be prepared so that when the press comes for we've got to have it, that we have something and said, here, this is what you should be replicating and handing out
exactly.
for free. Yep. An established environment that comes in and says, yo, you're doing something important. I got the equipment. I got the expertise. I got the money, whatever. You know.
We'll get the information out there and get it publishable.
Right.
And then somebody else will do the distribution.
That's what I think is going to happen.
Exactly.
Right. And it's going to be our thing that we're going to hand there and say Godspeed and just bang it out, get it out there.
Right.
And give it away for free or
exactly.
for cost or whatever, you know. And say you and we even say that on our literature. We say that.
Yes, public domain.
Public domain, and if you want to distribute and for free, we have no objection to your cranking out copies right and left.
That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought. Those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.